From any standpoint, the human toll in the war between Israel and Hamas has been horrendous. Tens of thousands dead, including an estimated 8,000 children, and hundreds of medical workers. An escalation that began on October 7th.
The world was shocked when people were ripped from their bedrooms, from their homes, from the different kibbutzim in Israel.
These actions by Hamas were war crimes, according to the International Criminal Court prosecutor. But so were Israel's alleged denial of humanitarian aid, causing mass starvation in Gaza. And a separate international court ordered Israel to cease its assault on Rafah. The battle has raged in the Middle East, but human rights abuses may be prosecuted in The Hague. I'm David Freudberg. Stay with us for The Rights of Civilians from Humankind. Humankind is produced in association with GBH Boston. This special project, The Rights of Civilians, is supported by the Humankind Program Fund. Can prosecutions limit the worst horrors of war and hold perpetrators accountable? You're listening to Humankind. I'm David Freudberg. Officials of Russia, of Israel, of Arab nations, as well as conservative members of the U.S. Congress, are unhappy with the office of the prosecutor at the International Criminal Court in The Hague.
Threats against me personally, against the office, to stand down, to cease and desist, we will not be swayed. We have a duty to stand up for justice, to stand up for victims. And I'm fully cognizant that there are Goliaths with power, with influence, and we have something called the law. All I can do is say that we will stand up to the best of our ability. We will stand up and apply the law with integrity, with independence.
14 months after it charged Vladimir Putin for war crimes in Ukraine, the prosecutor's office has applied for arrest warrants against leaders of both Hamas and Israel. If approved by the judges, the charges will include war crimes and crimes against humanity in the Israel-Palestine war. Circumstances in Gaza are dire. In early May 2024, Cindy McCain, executive director of the UN's World Food Program and widow of Arizona Senator John McCain, made a sobering announcement on NBC's Meet the Press about humanitarian conditions in Gaza.
There is famine, full-blown famine in the north, and it's moving its way south. And it's not just food, it's also sanitation, it's water, it's medicine, and it's still very difficult to get in.
This followed a report by the food program in March warning that 1.1 million people in Gaza, half of the population, had completely exhausted their food supplies and their capacity to cope.
I'll speak to the children. The adults, we know, they waste away, but children wasting is something different. Because they're growing, they're, you know, their kids at various ages, et cetera. And without proper nutrition, their brains aren't going to function correctly. Their bodies are not going to develop properly. Their bones aren't going to be solid as they should be, and to offer a better life for these people.
The food program report noted that malnutrition in Gaza stood at less than 1% before intense fighting erupted in October 2023. The brutal attack by Hamas on Israeli civilians and security forces on October 7th, which caught many in the Israeli government by surprise, provoked scorched earth retaliation by the Israeli military. It led to rapidly increasing starvation across the Gaza Strip, a Palestinian territory along the Mediterranean Sea. Chris Von Hollen of Maryland spoke from the Senate floor in February 2024.
Kids in Gaza are now dying from the deliberate withholding of food. In addition to the horror of that news, one other thing is true. That is a war crime. It is a textbook war crime. And that makes those who orchestrate it war criminals. So now the question is, what will the United States do?
War is hell, a phrase attributed to the U.S. Civil War general William Tecumseh Sherman. But in the 20th century, several institutions were established to place at least some restraints on the most horrendous conduct in warfare. The priority is to protect the rights of civilians, innocent bystanders who are increasingly the targets of military violence. Among these new institutions is the International Criminal Court, or ICC, which in 2023 indicted Russian officials, including President Vladimir Putin, for the war crime of unlawfully deporting children from Ukraine. Now the ICC prosecutor is investigating the war in Gaza.
We've been really clear about the ICC investigation. We do not support it. We don't believe that they have the jurisdiction, and I'm just going to leave it there for now.
White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre in April 2024. The Biden administration expressed a legal opinion. Whether that prevails will ultimately be tested in the court. But it's also a political calculation, at a time when President Joe Biden has strongly aligned with Israel. He spoke about the war on May 7th at the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum.
On a sacred Jewish holiday, the terrorist group Hamas unleashed the deadliest day of the Jewish people since the Holocaust. Driven by ancient desire to wipe out the Jewish people off the face of the earth, over 1,200 innocent people, babies, parents, grandparents, slaughtered in their kibbutz, massacred at a music festival, brutally raped, mutilated, and sexually assaulted. Thousands more carrying wounds, bullets and shrapnel from the memory of that terrible day they endured. Hundreds taken hostage.
A later statement by President Biden has denounced the Hague prosecutor as outrageous for suggesting an equivalency between the actions of Israel and those of Hamas. Also opposing the International Criminal Court investigation is Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, whom the prosecutor seeks to indict.
International bodies like the ICC arose in the wake of the Holocaust committed against the Jewish people. They were set up to prevent such horrors, to prevent future genocides. Yet now, the International Court is trying to put Israel in the dock. It's trying to put us in the dock as we defend ourselves against genocidal terrorists and regimes, Iran, of course, that openly works to destroy the one and only Jewish state. Branding Israel's leaders and soldiers as war criminals will pour jet fuel on the fires of anti-Semitism, those fires that are already raging on the campuses of America and across capitals around the world. It will also be the first time that a democratic country fighting for its life according to the rules of war is itself accused of war crimes. The Israeli army, the IDF, is one of the most moral militaries in the world.
Netanyahu says the Israel Defense Forces go to great lengths to prevent civilian casualties. But early in the war, a spokesperson for the UN Human Rights Office began voicing concerns about civilians killed by the massive bombardment of Gaza, some lying under the rubble.
We feel the need to raise the alarm, because clearly there have been multiple bodies discovered. We don't know how many. There are reports that some of them had their hands tied, which of course indicates serious violations of international human rights law and international humanitarian law.
According to updated numbers compiled by the UN, over 34,000 people have been killed in Gaza, including more than 4,900 women and 7,700 children. And Vermont's Bernie Sanders, who is Jewish, has called the carnage in Gaza a mass atrocity. He addressed the Senate on May 1st.
And to protest that or to point that out is not anti-Semitic. It is simply factual that Netanyahu's government's bombing campaign has completely destroyed more than 221,000 housing units in Gaza. So over 60% of the housing units in Gaza have been damaged or destroyed. leaving more than 1 million people homeless, about half the population. No, Mr. Netanyahu, it is not anti-Semitic to point out what you have done.
The images are heartbreaking of Palestinian refugees fleeing their homes, clutching their belongings in bags and sacks, trying to escape explosions and gunfire. It motivated Hala Rarit, an Arabic language spokesperson for the U.S. State Department, to resign her post in April 2024 after 18 years.
We have systems in place within the State Department to ensure situations like this don't happen. We are not authorized to send military equipment, weapons, to countries that commit human rights abuses. It is tantamount to a violation of domestic law. Many diplomats know it. Many diplomats are scared to say it. It's a violation of international law, what we've been seeing happening in Gaza. And we cannot make exceptions for our allies. It does not help our allies to make exceptions. All that this is doing is creating a vicious cycle of violence.
Also in April, seven aid workers providing food from the humanitarian organization World Central Kitchen were killed in an Israeli airstrike in Gaza. The Israeli military has described it as a tragic error. But the incident further aroused concerns about the conduct of the war. Chef Jose Andres, who founded the group, delivered a eulogy at his colleague's funeral.
The seven souls we mourn today were there so that hungry people could eat. They risked everything to feed people they did not know and would never meet. In the worst moments, the best of humanity shows up. Saif, John, Jacob, Somi, Jim, James, and Damien. They were the best of humanity. Their example should inspire us to do better, to be better.
Exploring international humanitarian law, which is intended to protect innocent people who become victims of military attacks. You're listening to Humankind. I'm David Freudberg. For more information on this segment, The Rights of Civilians, and to obtain audio downloads or CDs, please visit humanmedia.org. This is the Central Railway Station in The Hague, less than an hour's ride south from Amsterdam in the Netherlands. This venerable seacoast city is home to several important global courts that could pass legal judgment on the war between Hamas and Israel, and also Russia's bloody invasion of Ukraine in 2022. At issue are the rights of civilians to be protected from harm. U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas-Greenfield.
In the dead of night, President Putin launched a full-scale invasion of our fellow U.N. member state.
A worker surveys the wreckage at Maternity Hospital No. 3 in Mariupol, Ukraine. It had been bombed by the Russian Air Force in March 2022. Four people died, at least 16 were injured in the terror attack. It's hard to imagine a more brazen violation of human rights and of international law. Millions of refugees have fled their homes in Ukraine in a sea of misery.
Ukraine has defended itself with great courage and vigor. But the brazen and indiscriminate nature of Russia's attack has had devastating, horrific consequences for the entire country. Russia has bombed residential apartment buildings. It has bombed sacred burial grounds. It has shelled kindergartens and orphanages and hospitals. Russia has spurred mass hunger and caused so many to flee their homes. We thank the countries who have opened their borders, who have opened their hearts, opened their homes to those fleeing Ukraine.
These events started with Russia's unprovoked invasion of Ukraine in 2022. It prompted the International Criminal Court's prosecutor, Karim Khan, to obtain arrest warrants for Russian officials. He's now investigating human rights abuses stemming from the Hamas-Israel war. Tom Dannenbaum teaches international law at Tufts University.
At the International Criminal Court, one would expect that they are gathering evidence from witnesses, so witness testimony to the extent that they can interview witnesses, gathering evidence from satellite imagery, including open source evidence in that respect, potentially receiving evidence from actors that are very systematic about evaluating open source information and will be submitting their evaluations to the International Criminal Court, one would expect, as well as, where they can, sending investigators in on the ground to evaluate crime scenes. The Office of the Prosecutor of the International Criminal Court is very clearly doing that in Ukraine, where they have access to those crime scenes. It's much harder in Gaza, where they don't have access to those crime scenes by and large, but they will, where they can, try and gather that evidence. And certainly the international community should want independent investigators examining these potential crime scenes so that we can be confident in the results of those investigations.
With everybody carrying a phone that contains a video recorder in their pocket and with all the technology of surveillance, is it fair to say that what is going on in Gaza now is one of the most well-documented crimes in history?
I think it's certainly the case that conflicts today are more documented and documented by more actors than has ever been the case before, for precisely the reason you mention. That's true in Ukraine, it's true in Gaza, it's true in other conflicts in this moment. And I think both Gaza and Ukraine are, partly because of the level of public scrutiny, very highly documented in terms of what's happening. And in fact, in Ukraine, the government of Ukraine even created a portal through which civilians and citizens of Ukraine could submit cell phone footage and other information as evidence that could go into the evidence gathering process in that context.
Can you explain specifically how some of these attacks that have civilians as the victims constitute a violation of international law?
Yeah. International humanitarian law is the underpinning of war crimes law. And within war crimes law, there are various forms of illegal attack or wrongful act against civilians or other persons. In the first instance, it's illegal and indeed a war crime to target attacks at civilians.
So that would be the intentional infliction of harm on civilians.
Correct. It's also a war crime to attack civilians with disproportionate harm, where the target might not be the civilians in question, but where civilians are known to be affected by that particular attack, they're anticipated as collateral damage, and where that collateral damage is excessive in relation to whatever the military advantage was of engaging in that particular attack. There are also certain specifically protected objects that have a heightened threshold of protection, the attack on which would itself constitute a war crime unless there's an exception applicable. So, for example, hospitals have an elevated level of protection under international humanitarian law, and attacking a hospital can itself qualify as a war crime. Similarly, places of cultural heritage, what we call objects indispensable to civilian survival, which include food, water, water systems, agricultural areas, all of those are subject to different thresholds of protection, and where they're attacked in a context in which that threshold of protection obtains, so there's not an exception to the protection, then those would constitute war crimes as well. And then, of course, there are crimes that are committed against persons who have been captured. Those crimes attach whether the person is a civilian or a combatant. So if a combatant has been captured, at the point of having been captured, they are no longer a lawful target.
So you're not allowed to abuse POWs.
Exactly. You're not allowed to abuse prisoners of war. You're also not allowed to kill them. You're not allowed to mistreat them in all sorts of ways. And there are affirmative obligations regarding providing them adequate medical care, food, and so on.
we're exploring international humanitarian law, which is intended to protect innocent people who become victims of military attacks. You're listening to Humankind. I'm David Freudberg. For more information on this segment, The Rights of Civilians, and to obtain audio downloads or CDs, please visit humanmedia.org. The foundation for later war crimes prosecutions was laid in the 1940s at the end of World War II. The major allies convened courts in Nuremberg, Germany, and Tokyo, Japan. The Nuremberg Tribunal affirmed the principle of personal accountability, that individuals could be held criminally responsible for their actions during war. The Nazis were charged with crimes against peace and crimes against humanity. Late Walter Cronkite covered the proceedings as a young reporter. Mr. Cronkite, would you take us back to 1946 and describe the scene of the Nuremberg Tribunal in which the Nazi leaders were on trial for their lives?
The atmosphere at Nuremberg with the trial of the leading Nazis, the first trial, was very solemn, very gray. Cosmetically, the old Nuremberg courthouse building, which was used, was rather tired. The trial itself was in a fairly large hall with stands for probably a couple of hundred spectators at one end. Over on one side of the long hall sat the 21 defendants, led in every morning and took their place in two rows. And then across from them sat the judges from the four nations, the principal allies, in two of each from each of the nations. In the center was the witness chair, a screen with which some maps and other things, pictures of the occupation, pictures of the concentration camps later were shown. The drama was high when these arch criminals of our time were marched in for the first time, and we had a look at them. Head on, as it were, as they took their place in the dock.
I will now call upon the defendants to plead guilty or not guilty to the charges against them. Hermann Wilhelm Göring.
Bevor ich die Frage des Gerichtshofes beantworte, ob ich mich schuldig oder nicht schuldig bekenne,
I informed the court that defendants were not entitled to make a statement. You must plead guilty or not guilty.
Bekenne mich im Sinne der Anklage nicht schuldig.
Rudolf Hess.
Nein.
That will be entered as a plea of not guilty. Joachim.
As I said, I don't think I've ever spit in my life, but somehow or other, it just the urge was there to spit on them if I could. That came and went as the trial went on, as the testimony got more and more graphic.
The defendants were charged with committing atrocious mass murders of innocent men, women, and children during the fevered Nazi quest to rule the world, when Germany was led into the darkness by the rhetoric of Adolf Hitler.
Ich hatte noch immer die Hoffnung, dass am Ende doch in letzter Minute die Tschechen einsehen würden, dass dieses tyrannische Regime jetzt nicht mehr aufrechterhalten werden konnte.
The chief American prosecutor at the Nuremberg Military Tribunal was Robert Jackson, a sitting justice on leave from the U.S. Supreme Court. Jackson decried the Nazi persecution of Jews and Catholics.
What makes this inquest significant? Is that these prisoners represent sinister influences that will lurk in the world long after their bodies have returned to dust. We will show them to be the living symbols of racial hatreds, terrorism, and of violence, and of the arrogance and cruelty of power.
Jackson said the countries which came together to put top Nazi generals on trial for barbaric acts were bowing to a higher order of global justice.
If these men are the first war leaders of a defeated nation to be prosecuted in the name of the law, they are also the first to be given a chance to plead for their lives in the name of the law. They do have a fair opportunity to defend themselves. Represented here by able counsel who have shown their capacity to handle their case with credit. And these men now enjoy a favor which, when in power, they rarely extended even to their fellow countrymen. Despite the fact that public opinion may already condemn their acts, we agree here that they must be given a presumption of innocence, and we accept the burden of proving criminal acts and the responsibility of each of these defendants for their commission.
The Nuremberg Tribunal sought to inscribe for history an accurate account of Nazi crimes. Among those compiling the record was a brilliant 26-year-old Army corporal, Benjamin Ferenz. He had recently graduated from Harvard Law School, where he delved into a study of war crimes. Ben was assigned the grim task of collecting evidence at Nazi concentration camps as they were being liberated by the Allies.
I came in with the troops as soon as they got in, because you have to move quickly before the records are destroyed. And, of course, I saw all the horrors that have been depicted partly on television and film, including, you know, crematoria still going, the bodies lying around, you don't know if they're dead or alive. And my job then was to get in and preserve the evidence of those crimes as quickly as possible, which meant hitting the Schreibstube, the office where the records were kept, and seizing the records immediately. For example, in Buchenwald, I recall capturing the Totenbücher, which are the death registries of everybody who was there. I managed to get the records of all the SS men who'd been in the camp, sometimes their pictures of them as well, and the periods in which they'd been there, and the rank and the positions they held in the camp, and of course, statements from those witnesses that were still able to testify. These were immediately recorded, writing, and we didn't have the recording devices we have today. And then I'd move on immediately to the next camp and just keep going as fast as I could so that I could get as many camps as possible. But I managed somehow to build up a mental shield to preserve my sanity by just getting in and doing my job and moving on.
Does a person exposed to enough of this evidence of these atrocities, of these horrors, of these unthinkable crimes, eventually just become numb to it?
You have to become numb to it. You have to become numb to it immediately. Otherwise, you go out of your mind. I created a process whereby my mind didn't accept what my eyes saw. And without that, it could not have been possible to go on. You can't spend your time crying and wailing and screaming for revenge. There was a job to do, and you have to go on and do it, and you have to go on living.
Ben Ferenz went on to become lead prosecutor at one of the Nuremberg trials. In all, 177 defendants were charged for Nazi crimes. Most were convicted. 24 were executed. In 2023, Benjamin Ferenz passed away at age 103. Coming up, we consider the trial of Slobodan Milosevic, former president of Yugoslavia. He was accused of ethnic cleansing and other crimes that left 200,000 people dead. And we look at the birth of the International Criminal Court. When the Rights of Civilians continues on Humankind in a moment.